Keeping it real on CliffCentral.com. Pan-African Connect on CliffCentral.com.
Well, it's Monday afternoon. My name is Rosie Modena, a.k.a. the Afro-Yiddish Princess. It is 3 o'clock. Welcome to my show, Pan-African Connect, where we connect you to all four corners of our beautiful continent, finding out about different traditions, cultures, what people are doing, how they live their lives, what inspires them, and, of course, why they believe in the Pan-African spirit. But and this week, we go to Zimbabwe, and we're going to be speaking to my brother, Mr. Albert Nyati, who is world-renowned musician, poet. He's written a fantastic book for young girls. He does a lot of educational programs on the continent and also in the UK. He's traveled the world. You might know him through his song Senzani Na, which was written after the assassination of Mr. Chris Hani. Also, just phenomenal, phenomenal individual who we're going to connect to, find out about how he got to where he's gotten to. And also, one of the challenges that he's faced of being a male activist in Africa. But before we get to Mr. Nyati, we're going to start the show like we always do.
Yeah. You know what it is.
Black and Jewish, black and Jewish, black and Jewish, black and Jewish.
Yeah, you know what it is.
Black and Jewish, black and Jewish, black and Jewish, black and Jewish.
While pouring down, soon as I hit the shoe, I go so hard. I'm Rosh Hashanah, I'll blow the shofar. Get my hair did, reading the Torah. I'm thugged out, I set my enemies with the menorah. And I got the pedal to the metal, cruising in my minivan, coming straight up out the shadow. Hear my grandma talk, but there's nothing you can tell her. We on the way to meet up with our Jewish diamond seller. She trying to set me up, but I'm breaking hearts.
There's a great deal on kosher chicken. Wearing big glasses, but I'm chic though. My bar mitzvah was cracking all week, ho. I'm sipping Clico, and I'm keeping Shabbos. Every Hanukkah, I devour the roots and lockers. No paper planes, but I'm taking flight. I got a free trip to Israel, birthright.
You know what it is.
Monday afternoon, it is 8 minutes past 3. My name is Rosie Motena, a.k.a. the Afro-Yiddish Princess. Welcome to my show, Pan-African Connect, where we find beautiful stories, interesting people from all across our wonderful continent. And today, we're heading to Zimbabwe. I'm going to be chatting to my brother, my friend, my colleague. He is a musician, a poet, a phenomenal writer, and a just general, really, really great individual. If you want to call us, give us a shout on 0861-555-189. Of course, I'm on Twitter, either at cliffcentral.com or Rosie Motene or Princess RTM, and of course on Facebook and Instagram. But let me introduce my wonderful friend, Mr. Albert Inyati. How are you, my brother?
I am fine, Rosie. How are you?
Very, very, very good. So glad that we could finally get this together. How is Zimbabwe doing today?
Zimbabwe is fine. It's a little bit hot today. Mm-hmm. Some wind as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But let's before we get into the amazing work that you've done, not only on the continent, but around the world, you grew up in Bulawayo, am I correct?
Yes, I was born in the countryside of Gwanda, mm-hmm. rural Gwanda. And then I grew up in Bulawayo.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was one university in Zimbabwe called the University of Zimbabwe. I went to Harare because of the of studies.
And when you were growing up, did you always want to be a performer? Did you always want to be within the arts?
I'm not sure. I suppose it all came about because my mother would give me shower me with clan praises each mm-hmm. time I brought a rabbit home, you know,
yes.
a hare or a kudu or an impala or something like that.
Yeah.
So she would shower me with, my praises, the clan praises.
Yeah.
And, I'd feel good. I suppose those were the roots, the formative stages, as it were.
The beginning of it all. And then at one point you worked for the National Arts Council of Zimbabwe, and then you gave up that job to pursue your career in music. Now,
yes,
anybody who gives up that or decides to take that leap of faith, I mean, there's a lot of anxiety that's involved in that. Tell us about the process of what actually led you to realize that actually this is my passion, this is what I want to do, and your belief in actually just doing it.
Well, I'll tell you what, as soon as I finished university, I never applied for a job because the director of the Arts Council saw me giving a talk among students and then approached me and said, there's a job for a publications and information officer at the Arts Council if you want. You really want to there. And I got the job.
Wow.
However, with time, as I made inroads into the arts, with time I found myself having lots of invitations to various countries, Denmark, Sweden, Holland, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually I was somehow persuaded to leave my job. I actually quit as acting director. I was the director of the Arts Council for 2 years in an acting capacity.
Mm-hmm.
But I decided to go for the arts because for me it was lots of fun. You are a public teacher. You are teaching the public.
Yeah.
Specific issues from your viewpoint, as it were.
Mm.
Yeah.
And your first piece that you put together, your first music or poetry piece, what do you remember the inspiration and what it was about?
Pardon me?
I'm saying your first piece of music that you composed. Do you remember what it was about and what was it?
Well, I cannot quite recall because I can't remember.
Mm-hmm.
There's not that I did when I was young, but my major highlight really was a song called Senzeni Na.
Mm.
I know there is a version called Senzeni Na, the South African struggle version.
Yes.
There is one that I composed on the day that Chris Hani was assassinated.
Mm.
It's called Senzeni Na, which goes with the poem. And then I recorded that in 1994,
mm-hmm.
and it almost became some kind of national anthem in Zimbabwe. Even up to now, people talk about it, people sing it around when they see me, on the streets and so on and so forth. And I did a video. Yeah, but the very first one, it's difficult for me to remember.
Yeah, but with the Senzeni now, I mean, it wasn't just known in Zimbabwe. I mean, it's become incredibly prolific in South Africa as well, and especially because it was around this assassination of Mr. Chris Hani. And what was your inspiration for doing it straight after his untimely death?
Well, I suppose that, you know, I grew up under ZAPU, Zimbabwe African People's Union, led by Joshua Nkomo, and ZIPRA, which was the the military wing of ZAPU. Mm-hmm. And naturally, we worked closely with Umkhonto we Sizwe, with the African National Congress in Zambia. I remember one day at Zimbabwe House, I saw Chris Hani, people like Joe Modise, and so on and so forth. And when he was assassinated, I imagine somebody had spent so many years out of his country, and suddenly, coming home, you are shot dead. For me, I was imagining how it felt to his children. I remember also that later on in life, it must have been 1996, I met a lady called Limpo Hani in Amsterdam. I had a show, actually, it was not Amsterdam. I had a show in Amsterdam, and I was then invited to Den Haag, The Hague, to perform when she came along. I felt tears rolling down my cheeks when I saw her and imagined that that's what happened to her husband. And for me, I was highly charged with inspiration when that happened, because I was working close with the African National Congress. Apparently, at the University of Zimbabwe, I used to represent the ANC during specific days that were chosen by the student leadership, Culture Day and so on and so forth, out coming from the African National Congress. So I was so attached to that aspect that when Chris Hani was shot dead, it gave me very serious emotions, and I composed that poem.
Because that song has invoked so many emotions, you know, for people who were living in South Africa at the time, and also all around the world. Because you know, when I was doing my research on you, there are so many other orchestras, so many other performers who've made their renditions of the song. You know, so it's not something that's just resonated with Africa itself, but it's actually just become one of those global iconic songs, if you want to call it that.
Yeah, actually, there are two versions. There is a version which was performed by the African National Congress during the struggle.
Yeah.
The Senzenina, you know, the Senzenina. And then I worked on Senzenina, you know, what crime have we committed?
Yeah,
that's the version that I worked on. There are two slightly different ones, but they have the same title of Senzenina and the other Senzenina.
And moving on to some of your poetry, I'm going to play a version of that just a little while for our listeners, just to get a taste of what the song is about. But in terms of your poetry, what do you have a strong message that you send through your poetry when you sit down to write a piece?
When I write, first of all, I normally write at night. I fail to sleep. I wake up around 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning, and I start writing. When I'm fully charged with inspiration, I write till close to morning, and I sleep around 5 in the morning.
Wow.
I write about all sorts of things. You know, name it. In this country, in Zimbabwe, I've been invited to write, for instance, about even a Ford Ranger, a car, a vehicle called Ford Ranger. They asked me to write when they were launching it.
Yeah.
I've been asked to write about, you know, virtually anything you can think of. But when I write on my well, that is commissioned work. But when I write on my own, I get inspired by the creativity of people around me, everything, anything that happens around me.
Mm-hmm.
I remember one of my poems is called My Daughter. That one is really taken over from Tanzania, really like taken over.
Yeah.
And yet the other, and it's a book, by the way. It's been, there is a gentleman from Nigeria. I can't remember, it's called Uche Onyeuke, something like that. He took the book and said he wanted to get it to schools in Nigeria.
Yeah.
I just got a request from the Sutu, from a school, and so on and so forth. That book has done very well.
Yeah.
And we are now writing a sequel to that one,
yeah,
called My Son.
But let's just unpack My Daughter. What are the main elements and what messages are being sent through there? Because, I mean, it's an incredible, a powerful piece of writing. But just for so our listeners can get a better understanding of what the book is about.
Well, I suppose this is just merely a poem.
Mm.
It's simply a poem. And how I wrote it is that when my daughter was turning about 14, 15, I can't remember the specific year, instead of a cake or a postcard, she found about 4 or 5 lines on her bed.
Mm.
Because, you know, she had changed a little bit. She was no longer the daughter I knew,
mm,
you know, the little sweet little one. she was now making a few demands that I couldn't understand.
Yeah.
And as a father, I was not sure how to respond.
Yeah.
And when I asked some of my friends in Europe, they would say, "Whoa, well, it's not Africa alone. We also don't know how to respond." And they're about 16, 17, 14, 15, 17.
Yeah.
And you want me to just perform it for you?
Yes, please.
My daughter, when I demand that you be home before dark every day, I, my daughter, do not hate you, dear. I am merely trying to protect you from the jaws of the drooling hyenas that love to feast in the dark, from the panting leopards lurking in the dark, stalking you like ghosts, almost ready to leap at you. When I say be home before dark every day, I am merely trying to protect you, dear, from the hungry lions silently eyeing you, smacking their lips, ready to pounce on you, from the jittery and jumpy monkeys leaping from tree to tree and from branch to branch with no particular base. Dear daughter, when I say be home before dark every day, I am merely doing what fathers should do. It is my duty to protect you from the black mambas that hate to miss a target. They all want to win your heart, dear. And remember, the python preys on its victim by changing colors. Oh, old rainbow colors. Aren't they beautiful? Daughter, hate me. Darkness has no eyes. That is merely a snippet.
Beautiful, beautiful. And what was her response to it? I mean, what is where is your relationship now with her?
You mean between me and my daughter?
Yes.
we are good friends. We talk. I think that the few lines that I wrote, I think they were about 4 or 5,
mm,
opened up a conversation. Because it was very difficult for me to start off. So because of this poem, and that's what many people who have bought the book tell me. I mean, I meet a lot of girls, although I wrote it initially for my daughter,
mm,
it's really for our daughters, because all of them experience the same thing. You can imagine that we are all afraid of snakes, afraid of crocodiles.
Mm.
But there are some that we need to be afraid of. The butterfly. You know, the peacock.
Mm.
It looks so beautiful, but it can be the most dangerous of them all.
Yeah.
So my daughter, I think that this poem opened up a conversation between me and her, and this poem apparently has opened up some conversations between fathers and mothers,
mm,
rather fathers and daughters,
yeah,
and mothers and daughters.
Mm. Because it's also very, very important now, because you have a lot of single parents raising their children. You know, there are a lot of single fathers out there who are, you know, also questioning these different type of things, questioning whether they're doing something wrong or what path to go on. So it's definitely a global issue.
It's scary, actually, to imagine, especially with HIV around.
Mm.
I think it's good for parents to have the dialogue with their children, both boys and girls, be able to open up, talk about these things. Because obviously, as you can understand, as you may understand from our, you know, from our cultural point of view, it's difficult to talk about issues of sexuality and all that goes with it with your own daughter,
yeah,
or with your own son.
Yeah.
But that time has come. And some schools, some teachers that have come across this book tell me that you have made it easy for us to teach in schools to talk about these things.
Yeah.
Because we start from there. Obviously, I'm not talking of animals. Mm. Obviously, even the folklore, the stories about the rabbit and the baboon are not meant for rabbits and baboons.
Yeah.
They are not meant for animals. They are meant for people. And therefore, it's easier to understand from that point of view.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you mentioned now that there's going to be a sequel to the book. Let's touch on that for now.
You were saying?
You said that there's going to be a sequel to my daughter, a follow up after the book.
Yes, the sequel, just a snippet of it. This is a poem again, which is going to be in the form of a book.
Yeah.
Where to be launched next year, here in Zimbabwe, and hopefully I may be able to launch it in a few countries, including South Africa. Probably.
Yeah.
This one is, I wrote it with a friend of mine called Ignatius Mabasa,
yeah,
who is very creative, and I said, look, let's come together on this one. And of course, apparently, there is going to be one called My Mother. But before talking about my mother, I think I would rather talk about my son. My son came about because a lot of parents were saying to me, look, we love your book. Some parents were saying, I bought your book for my daughter, but I also have a son. Are you aware that sons also go through tough times? And really, I think I hadn't thought about it.
Mm.
And here's just a snippet. My son Shakespeare, do not just shake your spear everywhere. There are wounded leopards and buffaloes and antelopes. From previous encounters with hunters, they are angry, you know. They may want revenge. Let it not be you, my son Shakespeare. My son, never give your heart to the elephant. It will tremble and toss it to the laughing hyenas, who will chop your possessions without care, leading you to the valley of the shadow of death, where the vulture will massage you to the bone, my son. My son, never step near the animals. That is no manhood. My son, sometimes you must listen to your fear.
That is beautiful, beautiful. And, I mean, your poetry is also, just in terms of the work that you've been doing, has also been transcendent. You've done a lot of work in the UK. And one of the projects that you were involved with was the Chelsea Football Club in 2005, where you were working with children, creating poetry against racism in football. Tell us about that program.
Oh, it was amazing. In 2005, I was invited by Chelsea Football Club to, apparently I'm Liverpool, but I've since shifted a little bit.
I wasn't going to say anything about the choice of football, because you know I'm a Man United supporter, but for this time we'll talk about Chelsea, otherwise we never mention the team.
Oh, yeah, I've shifted to Chelsea. Well, if you go to Chelsea Football Club, today you will see me hanging on their education department wall. Apparently, in my traditional attire, apparently almost all those clubs have education departments where children come around and learn not only some football but other issues.
Mm.
So in 2005, I was invited. We've gone on a tour with my group touring Europe, and I then got invited by Chelsea Football Club in collaboration with Kick It Out. There's a magazine called Kick It Out.
Mm.
Kick racism out of football. And then the Westminster and Paddington town libraries.
Mm-hmm.
So they asked me to work with children creating poetry against racism in football in the junior library. And we did that, created lots of little poems with primary school children.
Mm.
And then eventually, when Chase was playing Bolton, apparently I had a show in a town called Norwich. Norwich.
Yeah.
I think North East or something.
Norwich, yeah.
So, I had to go to the ground, perform a little bit, cross the ground with children, and we had banners written, "Kick racism out of football." And I met people like players like John Terry, Frank Lampard, Didier Drogba, and a gentleman called Peter Osgood, who was said to be the king of Stamford Bridge, but he was an old man now. I was wondering why they were making me take photos with him. But I didn't realize he had been such a star. I was with the special one,
yeah.
The cold one, Jose Mourinho.
Wow. We're just going to take a quick break because we need to pay for our sponsors, and then we're just going to play also another version of Senzanina. But stay on the line because I want to pick up on other famous people that you've met and of course the amazing places that you've toured. So we'll be back right after this.
Pan-African Connect on cliffcentral.com.
At iStore, we love Apple stuff, but we're only human. Sometimes we drop our iPhones on the road, face down, and it makes us sad. That's why we came up with iCare Plus, a nifty little product exclusive to iStore for when stupid things happen to good people with awesome phones. It'll have your beloved iPhone covered for water, screen, and physical damage. So come to iStore. Why would you go anywhere else? Visit myistore.co.za for more info. T's and C's apply.
Powerful, powerful words. We're sitting in the studio here with goosebumps because doesn't matter where you are in the world, if you hear that song, it just invokes this crazy feeling in you. And I just needed to play that because our guest who I'm talking to from Zimbabwe, Mr. Albert Inyati, wrote a poem along those lines straight after our great hero, Mr. Chris Hani, was assassinated. Welcome back to the show. If you'd like to give us a shout, the number is 0861-555-189. I'm on Twitter at PrincessRTM, of course, at CliffCentral.com. And we're on Facebook, we're on Instagram, under Rosie Mutena or Cliff Central. Mr. Albert Inyati, so you've also traveled all around the world. Which have been your most memorable tours that you've done? Because, I mean, you've done Belgium, you've done Italy, whereas you've done the USA, you've done Sweden, you've done various countries in Africa.
I suppose that the most memorable would have been, I think, where there are a number. But I think Hawaii was amazing for me.
Yeah.
Just the sheer cleanliness of Honolulu.
Mm.
The fact that as you arrive at the airport, they adorn you with with flowers on your neck,
mm-hmm.
and you're going to see a very clean city called Honolulu, and you know that's where I learned how to swim. Actually, apparently I learned it as an old boy, really, as an old man. For me, it was memorable. I heard people crying. I could see people crying when I was doing the poem from the Severina song.
Mm.
But it was also depressing. When we go on tour, we no longer have Severina as part of the repertoire.
Mm.
We no longer, because sometimes people cry and we don't like it.
Mm.
We used to have it, and we replaced it with, I usually tour with, I got a friend called Makruna Hatebe from KwaZulu-Natal.
Mm.
He's from Mbange, Maskandi. So I incorporated him in, so we got some nice songs that we like Makondana.
Mm.
You know, he plays with Shabalala Rodin and the guy called Katas, who's called David Jenkins as well. So we decided to dilute that kind of grief with some Maskandi music from KwaZulu, and it kind of lightened it up.
Mm.
Yeah.
And what was the response besides, I mean, you saw people that were crying and invoked obviously some form of emotion, but what other responses have you gotten from people when you're touring a different country?
People love the music very much. They also love the poetry. This has really forced me to create little books out of certain poems. For instance, I can't remember, but I do know that there's a poem that I wrote about England, and it's called This is England, and I was writing about how no one gives the other a lift when driving to work, even if one is your neighbor. So the country is congested with cars, and so on and so forth. And Denmark, I spent 6 months in Denmark in 1994, and I wrote a lot about Denmark. So it's all contained in my book called Echoes from Zimbabwe. There's a section called Reflections.
Yeah.
So it's lots of Denmark in there. And the response has been amazing. I mean, almost unbelievable sometimes.
Yeah.
Really. I don't have words for it. It's been amazing. And sometimes I just look at myself and say, yeah, this is it.
You've got to pinch yourself and think, is this really happening to me? But what I love about you is that, yes, you write beautiful poems and create beautiful music, but you also believe in giving back, and you do a lot of empowerment with women and children. I mean, that's exactly how we met when you were on the Advisory Council for UN Women. Have you had many challenges? Because as we know, for decades, fighting the woman's fight has always been on the shoulders of women. And there are very few soldiers, per se, who have stood up like you have. Have you had any many challenges or people ostracizing you for taking those stands?
No, not really.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, in Zimbabwe, there is a lot of support. They even created a ministry responsible for women, for gender and women affairs.
Mm-hmm.
There is even an organization by men. It's called Padare Enkundleni, which is dedicated to working on issues to do with gender, in particular gender violence, gender-based violence, and so on and so forth. So instead of resistance, there's been a lot of support. And as I speak to you right now, I'm working on a music CD which contains about 16 languages that are recognized within our constitution. And I'm going to be going to various parts of Zimbabwe where in Gwanda, for instance, district, they speak Sotho.
Mm.
In Beitbridge, they speak Venda. In Binga, they speak Tonga. In Wow. Wangi, they speak Nambia, then in Chiredu they speak Shangani, and in Bembe they speak Xhosa. But the dominant languages are Shona and Ndebele. So these two have been dominant and dominating every other sphere. So I'm saying that the small language groups, so-called minority groups, also deserve space. So this album is going to be on issues of gender-based violence, on issues of gender, on uniting to end violence against women and girls, and it's going to be in the various languages by various artists. So I'm going to audition, I'm going to go from district to district, picking on doors. Remember when Mzilikazi left KwaZulu-Natal in 1820-something, he, along the way, incorporated a number of nationalities. This is why we have so many languages in Zimbabwe. Some of them you find in South Africa.
Yeah, there's a lot of crossover.
Including Isindebele. Isindebele is actually Zulu. They were brought by Mzilikazi. So we are going to have that kind of album, which will be accompanied by a documentary on issues of violence on women and girls.
Yeah. And what is the state at the moment in Zimbabwe? I mean, I know in South Africa we're in dire straits, and you know, the statistics of sexual violence against women and children is still escalating. What is the state of is there change within Zimbabwe?
Hello, yeah, I didn't get you.
I said the state of woman empowerment and rather of violence against women and children in Zimbabwe. Where is it now? Has there been progress?
I think there is some progress happening in some way, although we still have a long way to go. You have people who don't believe in that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But slowly, slowly, and using music, using the performing arts, theatre, poetry, comedy, dance, we are going to slowly work on the minds of the people to see the new world. We are not living in an old world where, you know, you had situations where women would be battered by husbands, where wives would be battered by husbands, and lack of respect for women in general in some cases. Things are changing slowly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now in 2009, you did an educational program at the Winchmore Secondary School. What was that initiative about?
Oh, okay. In 2009 and 2010, I was the British Council International Climate Icon. So the my work involved me working with children in various schools in Bulawayo, Harare, and London. Creating poetry based on climate change and environmental degradation, both primary and secondary schools. So we created these poems. First of all, I would get into a class, discuss what poetry is, you know, issues of metaphors, imagery and all, you know, the various poetic devices needed in a poem. And then we discuss the actual subject, which is environment or climate change.
Okay.
After which I then ask children to choose a specific theme or topic. And then each child goes away to write a line on that. Well, they spend about 20 minutes to write one line. Right? We talk about the necessity to be very mean with words, to be very, very economic, you know, with words.
Yeah.
You know, word choice, diction, very important. So they go away with this knowledge, you know, spend some time working on the line. Sometimes you're allowed to write two lines.
Mm-hmm.
And when they come back, we then start by asking who is confident enough to start off, to kick it off. The teacher becomes our secretary, or one of the students becomes our secretary who goes on the board and starts writing. And you should see the fight. Initially, students start by being very shy, but eventually they start, you know, really getting animated over certain use of words. They, you know, we start editing collectively, it's amazing, the excitement and so on and so forth. So that has won me many hearts in a number of countries, really,
yeah.
But particularly in the United Kingdom, in Northern Ireland, in Wales, and so on and so forth. And in England, they begin to be confident, and they start saying, oh, no, sir, I think that word is wrong. I think that phrase is wrong. We should have that. And they start, you know, it's so amazing.
Yeah.
And I have started doing that at home as well.
Mm. But you also, I mean, you love nurturing and working on talents, especially for young people. And, I mean, you've worked with a number of people. For instance, Marion Kononga, Iyasa, who's also had international acclaim. Let's talk about what nurturing and I suppose you could call it what mentorship you've offered the young talent of Zimbabwe.
I have enjoyed that very much. Mm-hmm. Remember, I myself was mentored by people like Lovemo Majaivana, to some extent, and people like Oliver Mtukudzi. I knew him when I was still at school. I knew them when I was still at school until they became my friends.
Yeah.
And, you know, to some extent, they've given me a lot of inspiration, a lot of wise words, and I faced the world at least a lot more wealthier in mind, because they forewarned me about issues to do with music, issues to do with being, public.
Yeah.
Sure.
And putting that message out, of course. And
yes,
I mean, you've mentioned Oliver, and are you what's on the plans in terms of collaborations with other artists, local and international?
Oh, there's a lot. I have a lot. I suppose one day we're going to have another interview when I'm more of that. There's a project that I'm working on right now. It's massive, and I will only tell you when.
Yes, let's not jinx it. Tell me when it's ready to be launched.
Yes, I'll tell you when it's ready to be launched.
Yeah.
It's huge. That one is going to take me 10 years. I'm only a year into it, working on it, but I suppose from next year we begin to concretize, and about 2017 it's ready to tour the world.
Mm-hmm.
We're working on it slowly but surely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good luck. I'm going to hold you to it in a couple of years' time. I'm going to give you a shout and ask you. But what other community projects have you worked on?
Well, I come from a very dry place. Called Gwanda.
Mm-hmm.
And Gwanda is about, my home is about 30 kilometers from the border of Botswana.
Mm-hmm.
And naturally, we are affected by the Kalahari Desert. So, therefore, the area is dry.
Mm.
And when I grew up, I was very, very naughty. I never liked school at all. I used to run away from school because teachers were, you know, very horrible. They would beat us up. Because we used to be playful.
Mm.
Now, paying back, because also, you know, when you are young and naughty and stealing watermelons and sugar cane from people's fields, when you are grown up, you then begin to want to pay back. So, by way of paying back, in where I come from, I drilled a borehole with the help of a school that I visited 2 weeks ago in the UK called Christ's Hospital School, which was established in 1552 by King Edward, who died very young. Well, I drilled the borehole, and with the help of many friends, including Chelsea, the wife to Peter Osgood, who used to play for Chelsea, including a friend of mine called Deborah French in the US, and so on and so forth, quite a number of and Seeds for Africa.
Mm.
Now, we drilled a borehole, and then we installed a solar pumping system because we don't have electricity, so we used solar.
Mm.
And then now, this year, we started 2011 drilling the borehole, 2012 installing the solar pumping system, 2013 we started fencing properly instead of using tree branches. And 2014, last year, we installed what they call, what we call a drip irrigation system,
mm-hmm.
right? And we installed a greenhouse. So the villagers, it helps about, I think that whole place has about, it's more like a co-op, but has about over 200 people involved.
Wow.
It's 1 hectare, and they cultivate vegetables of various nature, tomatoes, cabbages, and so on and so forth, onions, carrots. They even want to go into citrus fruit now. And for me, that is the ultimate that I can ever do for my, you know, the people who looked after me when I was young, growing, silly.
You're literally giving back to the soil that you came from.
Mm. Yes, yes. And they are very happy. And I mean, things have changed. It's a dry area, and usually they depend on food relief from donor agencies and sometimes the government. But now what has happened is that normally you get maize meal, you get cooking oil and sugar beans, and that's it. So what they are doing now is to kind of supplement that. And initially when I started this, I was thinking of orphans, particularly orphans affected by HIV.
Mm-hmm.
Which has really caused havoc in the area, like everywhere else.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what I thought initially. However, eventually I thought, look, there is no home that is without orphans. So every home has an orphan or two or more.
Mm.
Therefore, let me open it up for villagers. And that's how it is as it stands right now.
But touching on the HIV epidemic, how has the government, what has the government's influence been in terms of prevention and creating awareness around it?
Apparently, very interestingly, I am the brand ambassador for Population Services International, PSI, and I was circumcised last year.
Wow.
Together with my son, because I'm a public person, so they thought to use. I'm one of, actually, we are about 5 brand ambassadors for male circumcision.
Mm.
So the circumcision on me happened in Bulawayo. I started to go back home and be circumcised. There were over 1,000 people. But of course, I was not circumcised in front of them.
That's good.
I had to go to a tent somewhere.
Yeah.
No, to a clinic.
Yeah.
I mean, we're outside, there was entertainment, a guest of honor was the mayor of Bulawayo.
Mm-hmm.
It was all fun. However, when time came for me to be done, I had to go in. And I chose a method called pretext.
Mm.
Where they use two little rings to work on you, and it's bloodless, as it were. It's less painful, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I suppose those are some of the efforts being done by various stakeholders, including the government of this country, to try and reduce, because they say that it's been scientifically proven that although circumcision does not get rid of HIV, does not prevent HIV, it actually reduces by about 60%. It's been proven scientifically. I won't want to say too much on it, because then these figures are disputable anyway in the world. But I think that is a World Health Organization situation. So it's quite helpful. It also helps circumcision helps to reduce chances of getting cervical cancer on the part of your partner. So I decided to go for it to protect my partner as well.
Oh, wow. I've just learned something new also. That's very, very admirable of you. And in terms of the message that it's getting out, do you think it's reached the demographics that it's supposed to have reached?
Yes. numbers of circumcised men are growing, especially, I suppose, last year. I don't have the figures, but talking to the health authorities, they were telling me that they are doing well because all of our radio stations, television, newspapers, flyers,
brilliant,
and so on and so forth, posters everywhere, and people are aware. And it's all voluntary, really. Circumcision is voluntary, and no one is forced to do it. But I suppose it's quite a good effort. I believe I've also worked with the National AIDS Council of Zimbabwe, and there's a program called 90 by 90 by 90, which means, well, I wrote a song together with my other colleagues, the theme song for last year, 2014, and we performed it at the Victoria Falls to do with ending AIDS by 2030 kind of thing.
Wow.
In other words, almost reducing by 2020, we should, you know, have reduced new infections by 90%.
Yeah.
And 90% of those should, of those who are infected and affected,
yeah,
should actually access treatment,
yeah,
by 2020 and so on and so forth, so that by 2030 we have actually done, we are done with AIDS.
Yeah.
That's
you've eradicated it, kicked it out.
Desire.
Yeah. Albert, it's been absolutely wonderful chatting to you. Where can people, if they needed to get hold of you? I mean, I'll put up your contact details on my Facebook page. But
okay.
are you on the social media at all? Are you on Twitter?
Yes, I'm on WhatsApp.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
You want the numbers?
No. I'll put that all up on our Facebook,
okay,
page. But
yes,
please let us know what you've been up to, when you can reveal that big secret. We want to be the first to know, so we can tell our listeners and spread the word. And I look forward to working with you in the near future again. You know, it's not only an honor, but it's always just such a pleasure sharing a stage with you, because I think it's incredibly admirable of what you've done, not only for your country. You know, your name resonates across the world. So we salute you. Thank you so much.
Oh, merci beaucoup. Merci.
Love, lots and lots of love to you and love to your queen, my brother.
Thank you.
Okay, take care.
Au revoir.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. That was Mr. Albert Nyati, all the way from Zimbabwe, talking about the wonderful things he's done. You know, incredibly humble man. And we didn't even get into the fact, I mean, he's met heads of state. He's met people at top of government. He's met royalty around the world. But when you meet him, he's just a phenomenal man. The guy next door type of thing. So we salute him. I'm going to be putting up a little bit more information on my Facebook page. I'm also on Twitter at PrincessRTM. Drop me a line. Give me advice. Don't what you like, what you don't like in the show. Next week, we're going to be interviewing Gina West, who's going to be in South Africa. She's a Nigerian, but living in Ghana. She's a phenomenal, phenomenal songstress. She actually started off her career as a barrister, so we're going to find out her journey into this crazy world of entertainment and what's on the cards for her now. But thank you very much for listening. My name is Rosie Mutena, a.k.a. the Afro-Yiddish Princess. Tune in next week, same time, same place. Thank you.
Pan-African Connect on cliffcentral.com.